Welcome, everybody, to the May 2024 webinar, the Lunch and Learn, as part of the Genius series of Lunch and Learns. We are privileged to have a distinguished panel of Lunch and Learn speakers, starting with Drew DePriest of McKesson, where he serves as the Director of Real Estate Operations Technology, Lewis Parks of Veridify Security, who is the Chief Executive Officer, Andrew Ray of Smart Net Zero, where he serves as Director of Security, Tim Vogel of KMC Controls, where he serves as the Vice President for Connected Solutions, and I am Ari Rubin, and I serve as the head of KMC Consulting. I want to thank everybody. Our topic for today is improving cyber physical security of building automation and other operational technology for retrofits and new buildings. This is a hot topic, and we're hoping that after we do a little round of introductions here to get into some questions and discussion, and anytime during these questions and discussions, if one of you in the audience has a thought that you'd like to either share or a question you'd like to ask, you have the option of posting that in the chat, and hopefully we'll keep track of those, and it may be that we'll get to everyone's question. It may be that we'll have to be very selective based on the topics, but I want to thank you for making time in your day for this webinar, and let's begin. So why don't we go clockwise? It almost looks alphabetical, but Andrew, would you take a moment to share a story about yourself and just let us know a little bit who you are and what brought you to the table?
Thank you, Ari, and I really appreciate the invite today. So a little bit of background for people listening on Smart Zero. We are a specialist developing company that focuses on integrating the cyber physical security world, but also the energy and efficiency world, and that's forming a new form of resilience of the service. And we basically focus on the critical national infrastructures and the supply chain, so it's a really exciting time for us. Myself, I sit on a few number boards for the government, so I sit on one of the national home office based resilience centres. There's nine of them. I sit on one of them. I also sit as the peer review college for the government's UK research and innovation, and I also sit in one of the working groups for the IoT security and foundation. So it's been a really interesting journey. But yeah, delighted to be here with you, Ari, and the team.
And we're privileged to have you. Lewis, would you please take a moment?
Sure. Hi, everybody. My name is Lewis Parks. I'm the CEO and co-founder of Veridify Security. Our expertise is an area of cybersecurity, and with partners over the last several years have developed solutions for protecting physical infrastructure, OT, specifically building infrastructure and related structure, both new build and retrofit. And in doing so, we bring decades of experience in low-level device security, and as Andrew was pointing out, we participated in ISO, NIST, ETSI, in the Building Cybersecurity Organization here in the U.S. and more broader in terms of working with partners and integrators to deliver our solutions.
Perfect. Drew, would you please say hello?
Sure thing. Hi, everybody. Drew DePriest, based in Chicago. I've spent the entire 20 years of my professional career in some aspect of technology for facilities, for workplace, from design and engineering to operations to oversight and maintenance. Where I'm at right now, a fantastic company called McKesson. We effectively are a large healthcare logistics company. We ensure that medical supplies, pharmaceuticals make their way safely, securely from the manufacturers of those components, all the way down to hospitals, pharmacies, doctor's offices. So things that really have a strong impact for pretty much everybody. There's a tremendous amount of purpose that goes into it. My interest on the topic from an OT cybersecurity perspective really got into it probably 7-8 years ago, just as the rise of remote connectivity for building automation for lighting really started. I had my eyes thrown wide open by a handful of friends in the space around just how easy it can be to break into some of these systems and then what those downstream consequences and overarching risks look like.
Good. Thank you so much. Before we go to Tim, Kyle, I just want to let you alert in the background. There's some people having a difficult time logging in, so maybe one of your people could take a look at that. Tim, please introduce yourself.
Hi, Tim Vogel, VP of Connected Solutions. As we talk about some of the things that I do at KMC around cloud-connected solutions, more and more we've started talking about cybersecurity. And that's both a function of applying the Veritify technology to the marketplace and bringing that as a productized solution, as well as working with partners like Andrew at SmartNet Zero around building and kind of merging together this whole idea of sustainability and security of OT systems, which are particularly vulnerable, and but also of great interest for what they can do. These systems that we are securing are critical systems. They are life safety systems. And so being able to secure them isn't just a matter of protecting perhaps the financial side of a business or the data side of a business, but it is also the physical aspect of the safety of the people involved. So been with KMC for about 8 years now, working around telling these kinds of stories about people in the industry, whether it be through podcasts or webinars like this, but then also trying to get my hands dirty around helping with these kinds of solutions.
I appreciate that very much. I want to transition here, if you don't mind, gentlemen. First, I want to say that, as you know, this is a 12-month series. These webinars are occurring monthly on the third Friday of each month. And in the first 4 months of this year, we were doing, quote-unquote, introductory or 101 series or level of discussions related to what we're talking about today, but not as advanced. And so this month we're going to go more advanced onto this topic, and we're going to do so for the next 3 months. And then we're going to keep transitioning throughout the year. Starting around September, we're going to go advanced, so honor students only kind of thing, and get into these topics in a much deeper way. So at the end of this webinar, I'll share our topics for next month, but right now, Andrew, I'd like to start with some questions. You know, all of us are obviously keen to keep up with the latest things. We want to understand what's happening in the world. Think of them as demand signals that could inspire us to invent something or to take some action that's good or helpful even to create value. When you think a little bit about your history, because you're probably, I know we all get around the world and such, but you're probably on the extreme edge of that. When you think about cyber events affecting institutional commercial buildings over the last, say, 10 years, does something come to mind where you go, whoa, that shouldn't have happened. There must be something we can do about that. So I want to start the questions off with you.
Yeah, it's good to have a reflection sometimes at these things as technology and everything moves at a pace, doesn't it? So I think looking back, if we go back, say, 10 years, that's always a good little position to see where we are. So back in 2013, there was an event, and just to put that in a little bit of context for the audience, so back in 2010 was when the big Stuxnet event that probably people are aware of, that was the big uranium side linked to Iran, that was a major OT issue. So 3 years after that, and there was quite a well-known reported breach, and it happened in Australia, in a building called Wharf 7, which I think is in Sydney, New South Wales. That particular building, I think it's still today, is owned and run by Google. So not an insignificant technology company, as you imagine. And basically they had this operational hub that was going, and these two security researchers, I'll remember the name, Terry McCorkle and Billy Reyes, I think I pronounced their names. They were doing a deep dive on things. They were using something called a technique called Google dorking. What that means, it's like a Google hack, and it's using kind of advanced search perimeters to basically find information that isn't readily available. And what they were able to do is they were able to use a well-known search engine, I won't mention it, but they were able to find internet-connecting devices. So that could be anything, but it could also include IoT. On this occasion, they managed to find a really interesting one linked to a BMS. That BMS was a Tritium Niagara AX Framework BMS, and that BMS was what was running Google Wharf 7 building. And what they were able to do was actually get in and use a config file that was actually stored outside of the root folder. And within there, they were able to find the security credentials. They were encoded, but it was a very weak encoding, so they were able to decode that. And they were also able to find all the system configuration for that particular framework. So what they were able to do from that is they got the credentials in, they then logged in, and they were able to then say, to their surprise or horror, they were able to then find all the HVAC controls for that particular building. Interestingly, just a point of notice, and we'll come on to this, I'm sure, in the further discussions, is I believe Tridium had actually released an update for that particular framework recently. And interesting, the Google particular instance hadn't been updated or patched, which meant it was obviously open to vulnerabilities. So I'm sure there'll be a little bit of a theme coming here in the future, so I'll give everyone a little bit of a taster on that one. But yeah, sorry, Harry.
No, I was just thinking, it's interesting. I want to get back to you in a moment, but I was just thinking, Tim, you and I were having a discussion recently, and we were talking about an event, a Johnson Control event. If I recall, something to the tune of C-Cure, does that ring a bell?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That's recent. That's just this week. So how do you compare? First of all, could you describe that event a little bit and then compare and contrast perhaps what we learned since Andrew's event he described?
Yeah, so, it's always easy to pick on the big guy in the room. Johnson Controls is certainly a large vendor, but... I'm comfortable talking about this because we don't have a competing product for it, but what Secure 9000 is a physical security access control security camera platform. And what happened is they reported to CISA or CISA that they had this vulnerability, and essentially what was happening was Windows credentials were being logged into a pretty open log file that would be easy to gain access to if someone were to gain access to the system. And so, you know, critical vulnerability with a low threshold of being able to take advantage of it. Really, the way to fix it then was to delete that log file and to upgrade the firmware. So as Andrew's talking about upgrading firmware, really the main reason for us to bring this up is because that is a perennial issue throughout all building systems, is updating firmware. Typically, you would only update firmware if there were operational reasons to do so. I am experiencing bug A in version X, and so I need to upgrade to version Y so that bug A is no longer present. But often what happens, as is with many firmwares and softwares, new bugs are introduced. And so there was an inherent risk in updating firmware just for the heck of it, because who knows what sort of billable hours you're asking for at that point when something else stops working or your rooftop unit isn't running like it should because it upgraded firmware and fixed an issue perhaps you were already working around or whatever it is. So... yeah, the biggest thing about bringing it up is that it could happen to the big guys, to the small guys, and upgrading firmware is just not kind of a lever that people pull all the time. In IT, it's same way that you don't always upgrade, but I feel like the muscle to do so on the IT side of the house is much more there and in place. Whereas in OT, not so much at all.
I'd love to hear Drew's perspective. Drew, you represent a massive end user with decades of existence. I think you're almost, 180 years old as a company, something in that range? Hundreds of buildings all over the world. Two questions, really, when you think about the experiences or the events that occurred that described by Andrew and Tim and some of the, let's call it, protocols for updating, whether it's firmware or anything else, what is normal today for let's say companies in your sector, and I don't want to put you on the spot to be talking about yours in particular, but what's normal and what is, you know, let's call it 99th percentile performance where you're just, you know, smoking away everyone's protocols.
It, for us and for others that I talk to in the space, I mean, normal is finding the balance of operability from a remote perspective, especially as you get to a larger global portfolio, you have to be able to get into your own systems. At the same time, especially at an enterprise scale, and this goes for any major company, being able to do it securely. A lot of the things that Andrew's talking about with the WARF scenario, that was all through open source tooling. In the search engine, he's referring to different scanning platforms like Nmap, my favorite, that's who I'm repping today. These are all things you can find online for free and download and just learn how to execute a command line terminal. So I think a lot of what I'm starting to see more and more out in the space, and some companies are leading it themselves, some are engaging the market to help them get there, is really leaning into more of an IT and CISO mindset when it comes to managing OT systems. So the basics of just having an inventory and setting up some sort of autonomous scanning on corporate networks, which enterprise IT has been doing forever. I mean, they can tell you every managed switch, what ports are active, you know, which ports are down, where we've got different VLANs in place.
Right.
That concept is very new to the facilities world, but it's starting to get there where, you know, we have a full visibility of what devices we've got,
sure,
what their firmware rev is. So when things do happen, we know where to look to solve problems.
All inventory. But are there certain systems, and again, I don't want to create any troubles, but are there any systems that are higher priority? I mean, and of course, the subtitle there is, are there any systems that are more vulnerable and you want to somehow protect them more so?
I mean, just thinking about my broad experience of the last 20 years, it depends on the asset type. In terms of equipment itself, I mean, anything is a possible point of entry or a threat vector. So if it's an energy meter, if it's a chiller plant controller, you know, anything that's IP-based to me is something that needs to be looked after and hardened.
I'm kind of comparing and contrasting, say, a data center from an office building versus a warehouse, just in those examples.
Yes.
All three require, depending on where they're located, you know, cooling during the summer. But data centers more so, you know, depending on the kind of cooling. For example, if it's immersive cooling versus air cooling.
Yeah, I think there's two ways to look at it. So either the downstream impact of a bad actor getting into, I mean, I would consider public utility, so electric, gas, water, telecom. I mean, that's your hypercritical, and that's where we're starting to hear some stories of nation states trying to get into those systems. And then just below that, pharmaceuticals, hospitals, pharmacies, you know, the things that people rely on a daily basis for healthcare. Data centers in there as well. So either being offline, being down in any of those facilities has an immediate public impact. In the same vein, if for some reason you're not managing your networks well, you're not segmenting out your operational devices from your business networks and databases and lakes and warehouses, it's not impossible for someone to come in on a VMS device and then traverse laterally and go find, oh, we found credit card data, we found finance data, now we can lock up the rest of your network with ransomware and ship us $80 million in Bitcoin and we'll give it back. So it's the asset type, and then it's within those facilities how you're segmenting out those different networks.
It makes perfect sense. I'm trying to imagine being inside Lewis's head right now. We're going to hear about that in just a moment. But when you think about a zero trust network and apply the NIST standard to that, Lewis, you know, I'm thinking, wow, you know, if all these different asset types, you know, whether it's at, you know, in Australia or whether it's in, you know, Irving, Texas and everywhere in between, if they could have, you know, the kinds of edge protection, it seems like we could know and stop. And I'm curious what your opinion is on that.
So two thoughts. First, just to comment on the previous conversation so we don't miss it. So, you know, Patch Tuesday or, you know, the irritating number of times I have to wait for an update to happen on my smartphone or my platform is incredible versus the OT cybersecurity world in the place of buildings where a device will go on a wall, ceiling, or rooftop and perhaps sit for 5 to 8 years before it's touched again. In fact, most of these devices have no capacity for an update. We've built a platform with a cloud component you know, and our partners like KMC take advantage of it to push out updates, but the device in the field has to be updatable. And to this day, this is not. You go to any of your major building control platform companies or the edge devices are controlling, you will not see the, you know, here's our update processes and procedures. As a matter of fact, from another vendor, we looked at a building in New York City recently, 60-plus story building, and it was determined that 2,000-plus controllers, in less than half an hour, the building could be taken down. The cost was estimated to be over $5 million to put it back online because there is no automated way to update or for the devices to take an automated update from a platform like ours, which is what we're architecting. So what we take for granted in the IT side when it comes to an over-the-air update or updating code in the field should not be applied. Zero trust is interesting, and most vendors, including us, will talk about zero trust, and it's critical that you be aware of zero trust. But I think there's a lot of misconception about what that means to the market. And so, first of all, everybody should understand, and most people on this webinar probably would, that it's really a set of – it's an architecture and a set of principles. And I would argue that it's probably not even and because it's not, quote-unquote, a standard where a body has gotten together and – battled it out. Usually the titans of each sector group do that at an ISO or ETSI meeting. Probably the best document you can get is NIST, and then anybody listening, I'd go to NIST's website and look for 800-207, which is considered the reference document for zero trust architecture. And so basically, it's not a thing. So if somebody says that we are certified zero trust, doesn't exist. There isn't a certification process. It's not a program. It's really sort of a managed guideline. And you can go to a lot of different places to get to learn about it and how to get there. So to give you an example of, you know, what you should understand what it is and isn't, CISA, that Tim referenced earlier, the Cybersecurity Infrastructure and Security Agency, which is a great reference point for this type of information, has five pillars for zero trust, that you move towards in a maturity model. You know, you want to manage identity. You want to manage the devices. You want to manage the networks. You want to manage your applications. You want to manage your data. Not a lot of us are doing all of that as a vendor. For us, we do identity. We do devices. We're not a network company. We run over the FACnet, TCP, IP, whatever the networks are. We're not managing edge applications. Etc. By the way, go to the NSA. They have a seven-pillar model. These five pillars and two more pillars. So maybe they have a better building.
Well, I don't mind alphabet soup, but you know, it also inferences that there might be a government way of doing things versus a commercial way of doing things. And I'm curious. I want to go around the table a little bit when we kind of riff off of Lewis's comments here, whether it's the application of 800.207 or some other guide. How does it vary, for example, if we're, you know, a campus for the NIH versus a campus for McKesson? So, I mean, I'm curious, what are the differences in how we apply these standards? Anyone want to take that, or should I just ask?
I don't know that they might be that different. What I'm seeing more and more of is a very closer alignment of the CISO tower with the facilities organization. And in that framework, you know, any tools that your facilities team rolls within all of OT will have to meet whatever your enterprise company is following. You know, I can't imagine, and I can't speak for McKesson or others, but I can't imagine it strays that far from what has been publicly documented. I know a lot of people look at NIST as the standard, if it's zero trust, if you roll in the OnCorp. CISA has free training online as well that I started putting my team through, specific to industrial controls, but it's close enough. I mean, they mentioned BACnet in one of the online courses, so it all applies. I mean, to me, it feels like if it's good enough for the federal government, who are defending daily to the tune of, you know, thousands and thousands of potential intrusions, it's probably good enough for, you know, a small business all the way up to a large enterprise.
Well, So just to follow on that, I guess, and I'll come a bit more from a kind of a UK-centric perspective. So we've definitely seen the higher level, the higher tier companies really start investing, really starting taking note. Yes, they're aligning to standards, whether it's, you know, the NIST cyber assessment framework or 882, the various ones we could rattle off. What we have seen, though, is there still is a disconnect in the smaller companies that are within their supply chain. So when we've been going in, there is still a knowledge gap. They're just starting to get their head around IT cybersecurity, let alone OT cybersecurity. You know, their biggest concerns is keeping their machines available, keeping the productivity going. The fact that these controllers potentially are so old that they don't even have vendor support that's not been existing for 20 years hasn't been a major concern to them, because their thing is about throughput and getting out there and, you know, building things, machining things, etc. So I think there is definitely, in the smaller chains, definitely challenges. We've also seen it at local government. So again, national governments are just starting to bring up the topic of OT security and resilience. You know, they're seeing a lot of the nation states, but actually local government are still needing a lot of guidance, a lot of help. There's still a lot of generalism. So
I'm just seeing those pressures on budgets, though. I mean, you know, you think about some of the cycles with commercial real estate. You know, depending on your asset class, obviously, if you have a commercial building in a major metropolitan area somewhere in the world, it's different than, say, you know, a data center. Data centers, in my opinion, are somewhat insulated, right? They are critical facilities by definition. So, I'm curious, Tim. You service a lot of these areas. You do a lot of work with schools. You do a lot of work with retail and hospitals. Do you see a difference? Do you see a gap in how these are applied? These standards are applied, and some of the updates to firmware.
So it depends on the vendor that you're talking to,
sure.
And you know, like we'll take a school system for instance. You can talk to the, you know, the CIO, the CTO, or the network administrator, and they're going to have particular focus goals on securing all systems. You go and talk to the HVAC vendor that's just trying to, you know, maintain a PM or service contract. It's just simply not a focus or even a thought. And so it really comes down to a mindset, kind of like what Lewis was saying, is you have to have, yes, an awareness of a lot of these cybersecurity aspects, things that should be put in place, things I need to focus on as a vendor or as a service person. But then also you have to have the kind of just the behavior behind it to say, you know, I know that I have been keeping track of these updates and I know I need to make these updates proactively, which really ultimately then comes down to the strategy of the organization itself for the end user. You see, again, I think this is changing, but I've heard a lot of conversation around disaster recovery.
Mm-hmm.
So what are we going to do after an event happens? And it's like, that's really great planning.
Right.
What's the PR strategy, right? Yeah. And then just sort of leave it to IT to figure out the rest.
Right.
Now it's like, okay, now there's a process and a procedure that we can just continually work back to say that we're doing intrusion detection. Yes, we're doing intrusion prevention. Is that enough so that now we never have to use our disaster recovery plan? Well, that's the idea.
That should be the KPI. Again, right?
Through the stack, there's always a group of people focused on that, but you got to do it throughout the entire stack of vendors, suppliers, and stakeholders.
I'd love to hear Lewis's perspective. Lewis, I mean, you could tell the audience here, you just came from an important federally sponsored or government, quasi-government sponsored event. What did you learn there maybe you can bring to this moment? And in general, what do you see as the difference? Because I know you service different sectors.
So, thank you, Ari. Yeah, and for everybody out there, I was just at Joint Engineering Technical Conference for SANE, which is the Society of American Military Engineers. So, significant Department of Defense, U.S. Attendance, 2,000-plus people. So, just one comment to the environment on Tim's part. There is a bit of a problem here in the mindset of the IT CISO thinking and IT departments versus OT and what we're doing and running buildings here. It's one thing to have a billing system go awry and be impacted that you can't charge for a prescription, or perhaps HR can't put out a report for a few days because the server needs to be taken offline. It's a whole different world if HVAC system for your operating rooms, in the case of the event I was at, a warfighter event where two significant buildings supporting fighter jets that needed to get into the air were impacted by a nation-state attack.
Wait, can you go into more detail? This is piquing my interest.
Well, I don't know how much detail I'm going to put out on all of this as we sat there with everybody, but we, Booz Allen led a training session, let's just say an interactive session with all of us to input as to, so what should we be doing here? And I'm just quickly sharing that my personal opinion is that you're already losing if your issue is how do I message this out to the world that, you know, the billing will catch up, you will get your prescriptions, or you will get your paycheck eventually, whether it was through a paid ransomware or whether it was a wholesale replacement of all the network, as one city did in the U.S. That's where I am. I think that, where these different places are, I think there's also a hurdle here that was brought up that cybersecurity is a big, big, tough place. Not everybody has the benefit of having Drew on staff and the resources that they have for IT and cyber. So to Andrew's comment about medium and smaller businesses, you know, we walk into a 40-story building in Midtown Manhattan. They do not have an IT staff or a cyber staff. They have a person there who's making sure the elevators are running and the bathrooms work. And they let the fire department in every 90 days for an inspection.
Right. So they outsource it. They have some system integrator. They have someone doing the maintenance.
Yes. And then they have an IT group who say, there's a firewall on the network. We're good. We're done. And we all know firewalls have been around for 30 years, and we know where cybersecurity and cyber attacks have gone in 30 years.
Well, it's the same firewall for 30
right.
years.
Right. I was going to say, going back to your comment, Andrew, earlier, where have things come in 10 years? Could I still go in using – could Drew go take a walkabout in Sydney and use that tool he likes to use and just pull up the same IoT devices and stop them from working?
That presents a big opportunity, right, for service providers to go down that path.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Are you saying stress testing?
Stress testing, yeah. I mean, to go – I've known friends who have done this in the past who, not necessarily from an OT perspective, but I've heard stories of a team that was hired to effectively pen test a facility to carry a USB stick into the front lobby and see how many people working behind the front desk will actually plug it in and say, hey, I found this outside. It may belong to a tenant. Somebody plugs in the flash drive, malicious script runs, and within 5 minutes, the team in the van down the street owns the building.
I think the other thing I would say is in the last 10 years, the route to entry for people attacking buildings and stuff has changed significantly. So when you look back 10, 15 years, historically, attackers were a bit more, you know, the skilled individuals and a deep knowledge of the networks and things like that nature. Now, more and more, actually, with the technologies that's been created, it's a lot easier to carry that out. There's all the services. You don't even need to have the technology backgrounds anymore and the understanding to actually be able to gain access. So what you've done is you've made still the problem, still the challenge, where you're getting older and older kit, legacy stuff that didn't have security in mind when it was first produced. You know, it wasn't even going to get it close to the security silo at the point it was produced, to a point where you basically have attackers today, very limited capabilities, basically then can run successful cyber attacks in their house or in their bedroom or wherever they're operating from. So that challenge has gone in to a point now where you're getting into OT. Through productivity, we need to connect it, we need to get smart, etc. However, you are bringing different worlds together
right.
at different paces, which is going to mean there's going to have to be a sizable shift, or we're going to have some very serious challenges.
Well, I mean, everyone seems to want to connect their building, not everyone, but most people seem to feel the pressure to connect their building to the cloud. And I'm curious, Tim, I know you spend a lot of time with this, with your connected solutions. Do you think that... I mean, this is obviously a dangerous question, but should every building be connected to the cloud?
No, not every building should be connected to the cloud. I think some buildings, again, with their critical nature, particularly DoD facilities, with air gaps or, you know, we've talked a lot about war today. But, you know, I think those buildings necessarily need to be off. Whether they have their own infrastructure that is internet or cloud-based, obviously, that's up to them. But I don't think a lot of people, a lot of IT people, when they look at OT systems, if they're in charge of the connectivity side, will say absolutely no cloud-based connection at all, period. And or you can go cellular. It's like, well, that's almost worse. But they don't realize that. All they see is, well, it's not connected to my IT network.
Mm-hmm.
So there's it's a siloed mentality, I think, at times. There's ways to do it that's obviously more secure, and that those are the kinds of things that we would advocate. There's tools that you could use. But also, it's one of the things of if you want to connect to the cloud, make sure that that system is secure, but also go defense in depth and look at something like, you know, this isn't an advertisement, but something like Veritify that's going to secure the OT system as it is.
So go into that a little bit more. Like, for example, you say essentially applying good enough. So that's the inference is a standard. So does it go back to the standards already referenced on this discussion or something else you're thinking of?
There's going to be policies and procedures that are in place from the IT standpoint. But then again, going back to what is the mindset and the pillars that you have put in place for your OT system for your particular use case. I would not say that broad brush, you know, there's always dangers in that. I would not say that an auto dealership needs to have the same level of security as a pharmaceutical manufacturer or even a water treatment plant. Mm-hmm. You know, there's different use cases there. So you have to kind of build up and utilize the pillars that make the most sense for your end users and tenants.
Sure. I'm hearing, for example, from some over the last 3 months about semiconductor fabrication facilities, especially those in countries where you have a neighbor who is a belligerent who would love to either have your recipes to make chips, especially AI chips, or would like to disrupt your ability to make AI chips. Because it suits their agenda. So you would expect those facilities to maybe not be hardened like the Pentagon, but be pretty difficult to penetrate.
I think the other thing as well I would add, Ari, to maybe the conversation for others to consider is the other thing with the issue with OT is the level of number of unstandardized protocols that it runs, which is different in terms of the IT world. So you would have things that are running Modbus or Baxnet or EtherCAT or whatever it is, depending on those industries. All of them will have different levels of security posture you need to consider. So if you're looking and managing a building, not only have you got to consider the devices that you've done and the segment and your patch, etc., what protocols are you running? How are you going to protect some of them? Because a lot of them aren't designed with security in mind. So that's another level on this conversation that, you know, IT has managed to standardize a lot of its stuff. OT still has dozens of OT protocols that are out there and are highly challenging to try and secure.
Go ahead. I was just going to say, in a minute, we're going to transition to a couple questions, but please continue.
I was just going to just make two quick comments to tie back to, I think, where Andrew started earlier, and I think it's important for the audience. There's a cost to all of this, and there's only a certain number of people who can bear that cost or entities that can truly bear that cost. So even Ari, when you brought up the chip, you know, there is a program in the U.S. called the Trusted Foundry Program run by the Department of Defense to ensure their supply chain is secure for all the silicon that comes into it. I don't know if the products I get at Best Buy in the U.S. Are all, you know, coming from a Trusted Foundry. I think not. They usually have some very long foreign names when I look at my Wi-Fi platform after I put them on. Where they come from.
Oh, Louis, I'll tell you what. I was on the phone with the former chief information officer, and prior to that, CIO of one of the largest public companies on the planet. And without mentioning names, he was asked, his team was asked by him to test a device that was being used for real-time translation. So if you're having a conversation in language A and someone on the phone or the call is on language B. So in real time, you could be, you know, you could wear this and it would translate. It turns out using his tools, and he does provide what are called managed services to some of these mid-level companies now in commercial real estate. It was phoning home. It was phoning home. I won't say what home, but it was every few seconds it was phoning home and sharing what
current.
Yeah. No, it was shocking. I saw the scripts. It was truly shocking to me. It was so in your face. Like, we're doing this, and there's nothing you can do about it because we have a popular product. Yeah. So I'm thinking about those scenarios where I walk in, Drew, to your lobby, and I pick up a USB device, and I try to do a pin test, and, you know, wow, you know. So what would happen in your lobby? Would the security guard say, oh, thank you, Ari. Yeah, we'll plug that right in and see who this belongs to.
Yeah, before we go to the question, one other point I just wanted to make. So we just got the documentation to do a fairly mundane run-of-the-mill building on a Army base, and the guidance document for the HVAC system is 123 pages regarding the cybersecurity.
Wow.
Good.
So then, yep. You know.
I kind of like that, though, Lewis. I think that's a sign of the times.
Well, it might be a sign of the times. I'm not sure what private sector entity who is not, you know, in the Fortune 500
right.
can take just for the HVAC system, 125-page guidance document, not for the system network and how to do HVAC, just the cybersecurity for the system HVAC.
Yeah. I mean, I've just now started to hear this year the concept of cyber commissioning for OT systems. So no, it's not just functional anymore. It's, we're going to do an active pen test once you're done, and you have to meet that spec. I mean, to your point, like, you've got to have the funds and the budget to spend that, but
right.
there, at some point for certain facilities, there's going to be a value to
it.
Yeah.
Drew, I'm hearing some of that's occurring even at the design phase using a digital twin. I don't know if it is, are you all into that yet? Cyber commissioning at the design phase?
Still looking at what's out there. I have friends in other companies who are starting to lean in there as well. You know, certainly there are guidelines that can be just boilerplate into a spec. Even the simple things, right, of checking default passwords on systems that go online and, you know, not installing.
Even before there's a brick moved or supply chain tapped, I'm talking about, you know, when it's just a BIM model. Listen, we have a question from a person named Alex, let me say, and you can all see it. I'll read it out loud, though. Good afternoon. To what fundamental requirements can you can recover a building after a natural cause, such as a seismic, tornado, et cetera, or a human after war? So he's asking the question generally, how can you influence these solutions for the fundamental requirement of sustainability? I assume resilience is also inferred. So let me go to, let's see. Lewis, you're probably closer because you've seen an RFP recently. What's your response?
So we've had some of these discussions both with building entities and consultants. So the short answer is there's no magic tool here because most of the building system world is not built with any sort of redundancy, which is, you know, in a lot of systems, if you have building air traffic control system, you want redundancy. Nuclear subs and fire systems, you want redundancy. We've actually had this discussion recently where we've been asked to provide redundancy or a failover capability. So if something fails, maybe because of a tornado or seismic, that there'd be failover. The struggle there is the building industry does not implement failover solutions. There are not two boilers, two VAVs, two flex stats, two what
have you. Is this a U.S. approach? And I'm curious, Andrew, do you see something different in the in the British Empire?
The Great Empire. No, to be honest. I mean, again, it all comes back. I suppose it comes down to the cost, doesn't it? The cost to put these contingencies, the resilience things, is significant. And therefore, you know, if you're building something in this manner, you're building it to be functional, to be safe, etc. What you're not building potentially is these systems to be that resilient. And that's the big challenge they've got with the cost basis.
Andrew, any thoughts? Anything you're seeing that, for example, that we had some weather systems move through North Texas recently? Any kind of heebie-jeebies that causes?
Sorry, was that
it always?
I think it's for Drew. I'm sorry, it's for Drew. Yeah.
I mean, anytime, whether especially from a supply chain and logistics perspective, I know we have there are teams here as well as other companies that depend upon that that are always planning from a business continuity perspective. I'd agree with Andrew of what I've seen in the past in terms of if the value of these systems justify the cost of a redundancy. Data centers is where I've seen them. It goes from mechanical systems, electrical systems, all the way down to controls. I've had to install and deploy two different head panels for a chiller plant before that have to communicate back and forth at all times and know what each other's doing because that particular facility was so high value from a revenue perspective, they could not afford to lose control of cooling for more than an hour, you know, targeting downtime of like 5 minutes. But I think some of that for in the critical space contractual obligation, like if you're committed to five nines, that includes cooling and power. It's not just the power side. So if the juice is worth the squeeze, sure. Yeah, it's out there.
Well, Drew, you got the last word. I was going to give it to Tim. He had a drop. I will say, first of all, thank you to everybody. I know your time is valuable. Secondly, I want to say that our next event is scheduled for the 21st, which is also a Friday next month. And it'll be about comfort management systems and the integration of building level, campus level, and portfolio level. So the idea is keep going to the next level of sophistication on this topic, and we'll learn more together and create more value. So thank you very much, everybody.
Thank you.
I appreciate your time and wish you a safe and enjoyable weekend.
Take care, everyone.
Thank you.
Likewise. Bye.